I'm Russ White for MSU Today. My first hero in a lifelong love affair with the radio medium was the legendary Dick Purton, who first began visiting Detroit with his father when he was a child.
My original path to Detroit was simply because as a kid, my dad used to bring me here on his sales trips. I got to know the city. You know, I saw Tiger Stadium, which of course was Briggs at the time. I remember it was painted all green. I saw the bricks on Michigan Avenue, which is still there. And we used to eat at the Roma Cafe, still do. Used to go to, we stayed at the Statler Hotel, which is no longer, that's, you know, that whole empty space down there at Grand Circus Park. And so anyway, I got to know the city. So when I was in Jacksonville, Florida, well, started out in Buffalo, making, it was either 45 or 50 bucks a week. I was Guy King. Everybody who did the afternoon show had to be Guy King. And then I went from there back to, eventually went back to Syracuse University for a master's degree. Why I did that, they offered me that if I would just tutor some students, they'd basically give it to me for free. So I said to Gail, you know what, let's go back to Syracuse one more year. Who knows, it might pay dividends in the long run. It hasn't. Other than I was the only student in the master's degree program that had a car. And one day, David Susskind, I don't know if you remember the name, big name out of New York, public television and all kinds of stuff, was our speaker. And Eugene Foster, known as Fud Foster, our teacher at the time, instructor, he said, Dick, you have a car. Would you mind driving Mr. Susskind to the airport? So on the way there, as David Susskind flicked his cigarette butt on the floor of my car, which I've never understood to this day, instead of using the ashtray, which was open, he said to me, what do you plan to do? And I said, I want to get into radio, you know. And the other people in the broadcast group there were all television people, and most of them went into public television. And he said, really, like, do what? I said, well, I guess be a disc jockey. It's the thing that was happening in those days, and that's what I thought would be a good idea to do. So he said, well, maybe I can help you out. So he gave me the name of some people, one guy in particular, who owned three stations, one up in Washington, D.C., one in Richmond, Virginia, one in Jacksonville, Florida. So anyway, I ended up hooking up on Jacksonville, spent a year down there. Gail and I did. That's where our first daughter, Jennifer, an MSU grad, was born, and then went to Cincinnati and WSAI, and then after 3.5 years down there, had a great time down there, wonderful station. It was a top 40 station, and literally, as they say, owned the market. I mean, you know, we had like an overall 42 share of audience. It was quite remarkable. Anyway, but I thought it was time to get out after 3.5 years, and I thought the highlight was when we brought the Beatles to Cincinnati. Yeah, that was because I was getting a job offer from Indianapolis, and I was having dinner with a guy, the program director, from Indianapolis one night, and he happened to say that they, on that station, was WIFE, wife call letters, they had the Beatles for Indianapolis for August of 1960 on their tour, 64, rather. And he said, who's got the Beatles for Cincinnati? I said, I have no idea. He said, well, why don't you look into it? I said, that's a very good idea. So the next morning, he told me who to call. The next morning, I called New York, and all we needed was $12,500 down payment. And I didn't have $12,500. I had $2,500, though. And so I went to four of the guys on the station, and they ended up $2,500 each. So we had our $12,500. I sent a check off to New York. They sent the contract. We signed it, and all we had to do was give them another $12,500 the night of the Beatles. And, or, you know, they wouldn't take the stage unless we gave them the other $12,500, which, of course, we did. It was an immediate sellout, as it was all over the country. We had about 13,000, 14,000 young screaming girls there. It was a great night, a lot of fun. We have videos to this day, you know, of, with the Beatles in the green room and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of fun. So, but it was time to leave, I thought. So I called Gary Stevens up here, who was doing Afternoon Drive, who was great talent.
And was at Keener or?
At, up here. I jumped ahead here. Excuse me, at Keener. Okay. And he was from Buffalo. And I had met Gary somewhere along the line. I don't remember where. And I called him up and I said, Gary, I want to be leaving Cincinnati. Anything happening at Keener? He told me to call Frank Maruca, the program director. I did. I sent a tape. He flew me up and he offered me Gary's job. And the reason was Gary was leaving to go to New York. WMCA. And so he spent 3 hours telling me how great, no, 2 hours telling me how great Gary was, and 1 hour offering me the job. Maruca was. So at the end of 3 hours, he said, so? And I said, no, I don't think I want it. So I remember going, I got a taxi cab outside of Keener, and I said, take me to downtown Detroit. I hadn't been there since I was a kid. And so in those days, that was like a big deal, downtown Detroit. So I said, he said, where to? And I said, just kind of a restaurant. And he said, what, you know, expensive restaurant, cheap restaurant? I said, somewhere in the middle. So he drops me off at a place called the London Chop House. Well, I find out that what they call medium anywhere else is very expensive here. So anyway, or maybe the other way around. So anyway, I called Gail up. They used to have a phone booth down in the basement there at the London Chop House. I called my wife up, and she said, well, did you get the job? I said, yeah, but I turned it down. She said, what are you talking about? So I just explained what I just basically explained here. Well, anyway, Frank called me a week or two later in Cincinnati and offered me 7 to 10 o'clock at night. So I turned down 3 to 7, right? Then he offered me 7 to 10, and I turned that down. And the reason was I'd never done a nighttime teen show. I'd always done daytime mornings or middays or something like that. Anyway, he called me a week later, and he offered me 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., and I took the job. And Gail said, well, you've gone from afternoon drive to 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. I said, yeah. So anyway, I did that show, and they liked what they heard, apparently. And so they decided they were going to put me in mornings. Frank Swingin' Sweeney got into a little hassle with one of the other guys one morning when they got in a fist fight. And so they fired Frank Sweeney, who went to Toledo, and I took over the morning show 2 weeks earlier than I was supposed to. So anyway, I was at Keener 3 years, and after that I went to Baltimore for 5 weeks. They fired me there for being too wild for the town, is what they said. And then I came to XYZ.
Purton recalls fondly his days at the famous Keener 13, his first stop in Detroit radio.
Keener's impact was remarkable, and I had very little to do with it. And the reason I say that is because, one, it's true, but two, remember, I got here about a year and a half after Keener was already on the air as a terrifically important and highly rated station, number one overall. So I assumed when I took over that 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. show, I assumed a tremendous audience that was already there. And whatever I did, you know, fit in with it. I had never done a nighttime show before, so I just pulled all the stops. I did whatever I could think of. When I hear the tapes today, I go, that's me? It's hard to believe it is me. But then, after a month or so, it was Bobby Green by this time had taken over Gary Stevens' show in the afternoon. So they decided to put me on in the afternoon for 2 weeks to replace Bobby just while he was on vacation. So now I was able to do whatever the kind of show I usually did at WSAI when I did mornings, remember, and middays before that, and at other stations too. So they heard, I guess, I'm guessing, no, I never asked anybody. So they heard somebody who could be on in the morning and might work. And fortunately, it did. But my training, I think, at WSAI, which was a top 40 station, similar to Keener, with great ratings, like Keener had, too, was a great training for me. I learned how to do the top 40 thing in Cincinnati, came up here, fit in fairly nicely, and I just decided, as I had done somewhat in Cincinnati, I expanded on it in Detroit. I started learning the city, learning the people, especially the people that kind of ran the city, from the mayor to the police chief to the fire chief to the council people, the famous Mary Beck, for example. And so I started doing a lot of material on the air about those people in a, you know, satirical way, very hopefully funny way. And that kind of caught on. And apparently, as the years went on after that, even up to now, I kind of found out that nobody had ever done that in Detroit before. And to tell you the truth, I had hardly ever done it either, but I did in Cincinnati, even approached it in Buffalo in my days, did a few little things like that. But as I got confident about it, I so-called perfected it, I guess I might say. If I didn't say it, nobody else would. here in Detroit. So it worked for me anyway, the point is. And it worked for me for a long time. And then as the city changed, the city, it got more serious. We had a lot of fun with Coleman Young. But aside from Coleman Young, you know, the Mary Becks retired and Jerry Cavanaugh, it became, aside from Coleman Young, who was such a character, other than him, if you did something, it might be taken as racial. And I certainly didn't want to do that. So the Coleman Young stuff went over beautifully. Because Joe Nune, great voice guy, Joe did a great Coleman Young, and he got to know him, and so it worked out very, very well.
Dick Purton says Keener was a fun place to work and a natural fit for his evolving talents.
It became a fun place on the air, and maybe to work for. I mean, not maybe, it was. I had a great time there. I liked the guys. We had a super time. It was kind of a group that didn't necessarily hang out together, but we understood each other. We understood that we really had something good going. I more than those guys, because they were part of the pioneers that made it. I just fell into it with the connection through Gary Stevens and the fact my dad used to bring me to Detroit all the time. And so this is where I wanted to work. And the Keener thing just, with Gary Stevens leaving, they offered me his job, even though I didn't take it. But so it was just a natural fit. And it was a tight playlist, you know, it wasn't all over the place. See, the station in Cincinnati, WSAI, with that great 42 share of audience we had, which is a remarkable share. In fact, they took ads out in national trade saying the highest share of any major market station in America, assuming Cincinnati was a major market. Certainly was approaching a major market, not a top 10, but close to it. When the general manager down there was fired for being an alcoholic and just raising hell, he'd be at the end of the hallway screaming and yelling behind his desk laying on the ground. I mean, it was bizarre. However, he had a 42 share of audience radio station. But they fired him anyway, and they brought in a sober general manager from Dayton who decided that our top 40 songs were not enough and decided to expand the list to 75. And changed the news from wherever it was positioned to a different time and so on and so forth. And the station went boom down like crazy. And he realized, and it was maybe a few months later, maybe 6 months later, decided to change it back to the old format. And I remember standing up in the meeting and saying, I didn't think so. I thought we should, once we had made the change, now we should perfect it and so on and so forth. But anyway, but then I copped out. And I just wanted to get out, even though Cincinnati is a great town. I had a wonderful time down there. But assumed a great time up here at Keener. So it worked out well for me.
As the Big 8 CKLW began to demolish the competition in Detroit radio, Purton recalls a time when he had to stick up for himself and the kind of radio show he thought listeners wanted to hear. And he was becoming increasingly wary of the trend to program radio stations from New York rather than locally, like at WXYZ, a station where Dick would eventually work.
I'm a little conflicted on that in the sense that one of the competitors was WXYZ, where I later worked. And the problem with WXYZ was the fact that it was programmed out of New York by the late Rick Sklar, who overall did a good job. But one of the problems was this. to give you an idea, the biggest record in town at one point for about 2 or 3 weeks was Scott Joplin's The Entertainer. But WXYZ, this is after I'm at XYZ years later, wasn't playing the song. And I went to Joe Baccarella, the program director, and I said, Joe, why are we not playing the number one song in town? He said, because New York hasn't approved it yet. And that will give you an idea as the problem. Whereas Keener had one program director who was intimately involved with the station. Now, I had my problems with that program director, big, big time, huge time. His name was Mike Joseph. Mike, I think, is still around, I guess, but he gets the credit for making Keener what it was. He's the guy who they hired originally, a year and a half before I got there, and they kept him retained, you know, and he'd come back every now and then. Well, the problem was when CKLW came on the air with the Drake format and did very, very well, they abolished everybody, and they started to demolish Keener, and they did on every day part, and even my day part in the morning, but less so in the morning. Now, the reason for that is that morning radio is a habit. So people were used to listening. And so we were going to be the last in the morning to lose an audience that the rest of the station had already lost to CKLW. So Mike, we had a big meeting, believe it or not, on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock, I think it was. Sunday night at 10 o'clock, a meeting. And Mike Joseph was in from New York, where he did live, and he said, okay, from now on, it's time and temp. That's it. You have 10 seconds to talk, no more. This is to everybody in the station. And that's it. You talk over the intro or outro or both, and that's it. Nothing else. So the next morning at 1 o'clock, at 6 in the morning, I went on then, yeah. 6 in the morning, I get back, and I did the show as usual. He called me in. He said, you didn't like your show today. I said, really, Mike? He said, yeah, I told you to do 10 seconds, 10 seconds here, 10 seconds there. You did your regular show. I said, uh-huh. He said, you do that again, I'm going to fire you. I said, okay. So the next morning, I did the same show. Same show. So he didn't say a word. Tuesday morning, not a word was said. Wednesday morning, I did the same show again. Same kind of show, you know. And I didn't use the exact same lines and words. But anyway, he did call me in then on Wednesday morning, and he said, I told you I was going to fire you if you did that show again. I said, yeah, I know you did. And he said, I'll give you one more chance. I said, okay. So Thursday morning, I did the same show. Friday morning, I did the same show. Now, I get a call from the general manager, Walter Patterson. Tough, tough man. Tough man. Mr. Patterson would like to see you. I think his secretary was Grace, I think. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, she was a sweet lady. We'd like to see you at 10 a.m. when you're off the air. I said, okay. I said, oh, this is the Come to Jesus meeting right here. So it was Mike Joseph, myself, Walter Patterson. I can tell you the exact seats, you know, we were sitting in. And Walter Patterson said to me, basically, in fact, he did. He said, if you don't do what Mike says to do, he said, you'll be through in this business. I said, really? And I looked at Mike and I said, so this man holds my future in his hands. And Mr. Patterson said, yes, that's correct. And I said, well, you know what, Mr. Patterson? I think I'm going to take my chances. So I stood up, started to leave to go to the door. He said, oh, Dick, sit down. I knew I had him. He said, all right, here's the deal. Dick, you continue to do your show the way you want to do your show. Talk as much as you want. Just play, you know, play enough music that makes people happy. And Mike, the station is yours the rest of the day. From 9, or no, 10. 10 in the morning, I guess it was, to 6 the next morning. So I looked at Mike, and he was steaming. Oh, was he steaming. But anyway, that's the way it went. So, and that's what I did. At this point, I get an offer a few weeks, months later, whatever it was, from WWJ, playing music at the time, offered me the morning show. And I didn't take it, obviously. And the reason I didn't take it, they offered me a lot of money. So I went back to Keener, and I said, look, I've been offered this amount of money from WWJ to the morning show, and I'm thinking of taking it. And they said, how much? I told them, and they said, we'll match it. So I said, okay. So I stayed at Keener. But then afterward, I thought that it was time to get out. So at that point, I left to go to Baltimore when the program director had called me, a guy named Don Kelly, and offered me a morning drive at WBAL, which is kind of a JR kind of station, very much so. That's one of the reasons, now that it comes up, that I didn't take the WJR job when McCarthy died. I had been through a WJR kind of station, and I was not the kind of guy that they want with their serious approach with the interviews and so on and so forth. Just not, and I was unwilling to change my show to accommodate their show, that kind of thing. That was the basic reason on the JR thing. But so that's I ended up going to Baltimore, but it lasted 5 weeks, got fired for being too wild for the town. Unbelievable. So 5 weeks later, I'm out of work. I called Joe Buccarella back at WXYZ, who had already offered me afternoon drive. And they had offered me $40,000 to do afternoon drive, which was very good money at the time, very good money. And I was amazed they'd offered me that much money. And so I said, I guess I'd take this job. Except, that's right, I went to Baltimore after they first made the offer. I turned down the 40. I went to Baltimore for $35,000. Did not sign a contract. They wanted me to, but I didn't. It's too bad I didn't. I would have made a lot more money because they fired me 5 weeks later. And I was told I could do anything on the air to youthify the station. You know, we need a younger audience, but apparently I was too young for their taste. in terms of the material, I guess. I would never agree with that. I was so mild about it. It was just, you know. Anyway, the point is that I came back to XYZ. But here's the thing. They'd offered me $40,000 a year before I went to Baltimore, XYZ had. The offer was now down to $25,000 a year for afternoon drive. So Philadelphia, at that time I made a call to Philadelphia, WIP. They'd offer me $18,000 to do like 7 to midnight type stuff. So the $25,000, I said, well, maybe. So I put my tail between my legs. How about my head between my legs? I think that's a little better. It's easier to do. And maybe or maybe not. So anyway, I took the job, and things instantly improved over there. And then they decided to put me in morning drive. And so I just went, I shot right up the scale. And they had a big party. I remember when we went, Martin and Howard, and God bless, Specs is still around. What a great guy. He's in his 90s and doing well with Specs Howard School, you know. So yeah. Anyway, they were not doing well in morning drive at all. I think they had a four share in the morning after Fred Wolf had been a monster in this town for years, but the ratings had generally just diminished, something awful. So I'd been there doing morning and afternoon drive for, I think it was around 6 months, maybe a little less than that, I'm not sure. But anyway, it turned out we had gone in the morning from a four share to a 10, and afternoon drive, which, believe it or not, in the Pulse thing had a one share, went to a 10. So we had a 10 and a 10. So they had a big party at XYZ, and they just forgot to invite one guy, and that was me. And so, and Joe Baccarella, they made him drink. He was not a drinker, and they made him drink champagne for the first time to celebrate the ratings. And I heard about the party the next day. But anyway, such is radio and, you know, fun and games.
Purton says he first started to hone his on-air philosophy listening to morning radio in Buffalo, where he grew up, and then later to groundbreaking morning teams in New York. His goal was always to entertain and be informative.
I think that my philosophy developed by listening to morning radio in Buffalo, where I grew up with my parents, a guy named Clint Buhlman. But Clint Buhlman was very good on service, time, and traffic, and the things that you hear on a JR kind of station. And so I had that aspect of radio, what was important. And but then when I was in New York for a little while, I'd go on trips there, visit friends there, and they listened to morning team Klavan and Finch on WNEW. And by the way, I would later get two job offers from WNEW and turn both of them down. Anyway, but by that time, they were not the station they were back originally. But anyway, so, and they were hysterical. I also heard Bob and Ray when I was in New York. And then later I heard them on the Mutual, NBC had a weekend service or something. And they were fabulous, too. But I actually liked Bob and Ray better because they were more sounding like they were more spontaneous. Indeed, I think they were. I got to stand in the studio with them one morning. I hitchhiked from Syracuse, where I was a student, to New York City. And I got up in the, one of the salesmen let me in at 7 a.m. when I was waiting at the outside door in the building. And got in and watched them do their show. And gosh, they were so good. And I remember it was ASCAP or BMI time, where you used to keep track of the music you played. And what they would do, there was a guy in the studio with them, and a typewriter. And he was about 10, 15 feet away from where they stood up and did their show with a couple of turntables or three turntables and stuff. So when they would finish playing a record, they would take the record off the turntable, and the guy with the typewriter would keep track of the song, but they'd take the record, the 45, and they'd swing it against the back wall. And then the guy would have to get up from his chair and get it and then type it up. I just loved it. I loved what they did, how they did it. And that's where I first heard that kind of radio. The problem was that Klavan did basically himself, and D. Finch, no, it was the other way around, did basically himself, and Gene Klavan did the voices. And the problem was that I couldn't, and to this day can't do voices, cannot do it. So while I wanted to do that kind of show, I had to hire people to do the voices, which I did right to the very end. So, which fortunately worked out for me. But anyway, so it was Klavan and Finch. So therefore, Did I want to, my concept, was it to entertain? Yes, definitely. That was the concept from the beginning to the end, to entertain. That was the concept of the show. And then if I couldn't entertain, if it wasn't funny, it wasn't witty, it wasn't this, it wasn't that, then I realized then I had to be informative. So if you can't entertain, be informative. And that's basically, that's the theory.
When Purton retired from radio in 2010, he was already beginning to see what he sees as a decline in local morning radio. It was becoming more about music than locally based talent, entertainment, and information. So he decided it was time to hang up the microphone and headphones.
Well, I know that in March of 2010, it's hard to believe it's been that long since retirement days at OMC. But a number of people around the country at that time on doing morning shows that I think were probably entertaining morning shows. They were well-known morning shows, though. They did very well and made a lot of money, I guess, and money for the station and so forth. There was a whole bunch of them that retired. And I was one of them. It was untenable. And I'll tell you why it was untenable. It was untenable because they kept increasing the number with the PPM, the new rating, automatic, whatever, rating service. And I still don't, to this day, quite understand it. But all the point is that the CBS, out of New York, and then with the program directors, you know, local, wanted me to play more and more music. It got up to they wanted me to play like 10 records an hour. And then it was, and I might have played in those days 6 to 8. 6 to 8, depending. If we could think of something funny, it was 6. If it wasn't funny, it'd be 8. And so then 10, then it went to 12, then it went to 14. I think it ended on 14. And I said, this is absolutely outrageous. This is not me. One time, listening to the competition, the music guys in the morning, or the guys in the morning, I should say, and they were playing much more music, too. And I'm going, so I guess this is, then I read about these guys in L.A., who's the guy that does, you know, the American Idol
Brian
guy?
Seacrest?
Yeah, where he called up, I guess, the CBS affiliate guys in L.A., and he said, they're asking me to play all this music. I've got the number one show in L.A., but I've got to play all this more music. And they said, we're the same way, this two-man team, whoever they were. And so I realized that this was going on all over the country. This was a set pattern, especially by, in this case, CBS, because they owned OMC and they owned the two guys in L.A. that Seacrest had called. So it was a battle that I didn't want to play anymore in any way, because, quite honestly, I didn't want to do it. Also, I felt it was demeaning to me and the audience to do that for what they we at the time. I know that 2554 was and still is, I guess, the best demo, the big demo. That's the advertising number one request. But we were far and away number one 3564 and had been for a long time. I mean, it'd been in that demo, we've been number one as I can recall. I remember when JP was still alive. So, and he died when? 95. So, and that was a big demo for him, too. But anyway, so it was just, you know, some battles, you know, it's time to retire from the field.
While he's dismayed about much of the current state of radio, he is optimistic that things will get better someday, especially on local talk radio.
I think that everything changes. Everything has its day, and the day returns many times. I think that the morning audience, which why I never believed any of the PPM stuff, because they didn't. I don't believe the morning audience really wanted to hear music, music, music. They wanted to, you know, wake up and laugh a little bit, enjoy the day, maybe relate to the, you know, the person on the air. And I really feel sorry. I really, really, really do. I was just saying this to my wife, Gail, the other day. When I listen to the guys on the radio, and not necessarily mornings because I sleep in, but I feel sorry for them because I know what the rules are. And it's pathetic. And the, you know, taping ahead of time, what is that? You know what I mean? The voice tracking, yeah. You know. And so they pay guys part-time money for what turns out to be a full-time show. I know Al Pitter used to work at Channel 7, years ago and did, you know, he was voiceover stuff. I ran into Al recently, and I remember him telling me at the time that he was now had been placed on part-time duty because it took 1 hour a day to record all the spots for the entire day. And then he'd go home. So that, but that, would, that was happening all over the country. Do I think that the future is bright for radio people in general? No, I don't. But I do think that there will be someday maybe a personality return to personality radio, especially in the morning. But I must confess that when I'm with, let's say, Sirius XM, and if I'm listening to music, which is not very often, but when I am, which, in fact, that's the only place I listen to music is a Sirius XM, and that is that I don't want to hear any talk. Cousin Brucey, for example, on Sirius XM, if I'm listening to, what is it, 60s channels he's on, I just want to hear the 60s music. That's all. I don't want to hear what Cousin Brucey has to say about this, that, or the other thing. So I'm one of the guilty party, too, you know, the audience out there that said, I just want to hear more music. But I listen to talk radio all the time, and so it's seldom a problem. We have two cars, and in one of my cars, I just canceled Sirius XM, which I never thought I would do. But I did it because it dawned on me that on local radio, on for talk radio, I hear anything I want to hear right here locally. So why pay a fee to pay to hear the same thing I can hear for free here?
Dick Pertin's advice for young people who want to get into this constantly evolving broadcast and communications world is to understand and embrace what appear to be the industries of the future.
Well, you know, five of my six daughters, our six daughters, as I've said before, you know, it took Gail 54 months, took me about 6 minutes. So, and I hate to brag, but, you know, you have to tell the truth. But anyway, it's, I guess I would say to young people today, especially the people up at Michigan State who are in the broadcasting field, to also get into the high-tech communications field in terms of Internet and what's to come after the Internet. I mean, get into the and understand how you, and I realize this is beyond the interest and the capabilities of many students, including a guy like me. But as you can attach yourself as much as you can to the industries of the future, what appear to be, anyway, the industries of the future. And there will be other ones that they haven't even announced yet, so I can't even speak to them, of course. But because you've got to make money. That's the problem. You have to make money. And if you don't make money, it limits a lot you can do in life. It's not everything, but it's an awful lot, an awful lot. And that's why I guess, changed stations so much that when I got, I mean, I worked at five different stations, and if you call in Detroit, if you call a call letter change, if you count that, six different stations. That was 95.5, which went from Cozy to KQI. In fact, I even picked out the call letters KQI. But also, in fact, I had a piece of the action, too. And that worked out very well for me. And I negotiated that myself. My attorney, Henry, couldn't make a dinner one night. That was going to be a very big dinner with all the big guys were there from out of town. And my contract was up. And they said, we talked vaguely about it and so on. So I said, well, look at guys. I said, if you want me to stay, and we had super ratings. In those days, we had like a 10-share 25-54. This is in the 80s. And I said, I would like to get into an ownership position at this station. And anyway, as the evening was over and the more they drank and the less that I did, I had 15% of 95.5. And I don't know how many guys in this town have ever owned any stations that were on the air, guys, I mean. But I did have that. So later on, I decided to that I wanted to get out. I didn't like them. I didn't like the format because they still got to go more top 40, and there were a bunch of reasons. And so OMC wanted me badly at that time, and that was when the JR thing, I guess, was going on too. So anyway, I just negotiated the deal. Eventually, though, year or two later, whatever it was, I guess it was a year later, I said, guys, you can buy me out if you want. I think this is, I'm fine, just buy me out. So they did. They bought me out, and I was, you know, I was a pig in manure, as they say. Something like that, they say. And so I got out of the contract, and the ownership position, went over to OMC, stayed there, what, 14 years, I guess it was. So anyway, that was my own situation. But if it was me to start over again, wow. I think I could do the radio thing again. I mean, after all those years, I'm quite confident I could do the radio thing again. But as far as technical things, even as simple as some of the internet stuff, I call my daughters up. You know, girls, can you come over, or one of them at a time? Show me what to do here, how to do this, how to do that. And so it would have been tough for me to get a degree or more experience in the stuff that's now happening in this world. You know, I was okay for what I was at the time that it was working. And now times are beyond that. The technical things are more important now than the human being. But I do believe the human being will come back. All the stuff about robots we hear, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of robots. But I think a lot of the people on the air now are treated as robots, come off sounding like robots. And I'm hopeful the day when, just by force of nature and desire of the listening audience, that they want to hear real human beings talk about real human things and not just, you know, a minute here and 30 seconds there and play another song.
During our conversation, Purton referenced a couple times his decision not to succeed J.P. McCarthy at WJR when that morning radio legend died suddenly in 1995. Here he provides the inside story on how close he came to moving to WJR, Mike Feasey's honesty, and the fact that Purton felt he'd already tried the JR thing in Baltimore ultimately led him to decline the opportunity. It just didn't feel right.
One day I was playing golf at the Dick Purton golf tournament, and it was out in Romeo, and we'd been out there 5 or 6 years. Anyway, I get a phone call as I'm pulling in the driveway, the parking lot, probably about 10 in the morning, and it's Mike Feasey on the phone, and he said that he wants to get together and talk to me about doing mornings. And I said, well, they had at the time Jimmy Barrett, who had big, ballsy voice, you know. And I thought Barrett was pretty good. And the little I heard of him. So anyway, kind of wrecked my whole day. I remember going up to my friend Big Al, who, you know, worked with many years, and he was at the golf tournament naturally. And I told him about it, I didn't tell anybody else. And I said, man, I don't want to go to JR. I don't even want to think about it. So, but anyway, the point is, I called Mike and I said, yeah, I guess we could meet. That's fine. We'll hear what you have to say. So we met here at the house, my house. We had a number of meetings here. We probably had 4 or 5 meetings here. So finally, he asked for a handshake on the thing. So I thought, oh, man, I do not want to do a handshake. I don't want to do it. And I said to him, I said, Mike, I said, I feel uncomfortable doing this. He said, well, give me a partial, you know, handshake here, whatever. So, you know, it was a real, like, a girly handshake, you know, like if you were in a college fraternity and the guy gave you kind of a wimpy handshake, not that girl handshakes are wimpy, because I've shaken a lot of girls' hands that are pretty strong, stronger than me. But anyway, I gave him this little wimpy handshake. I said, but I can't sign delivered. I can't do it. And he still wanted to talk some more about it. So he called me up one day, and this was a real clincher. He called me here at the house, and he called me at about 4:30 in the afternoon. He said, Dick, he said, I'm calling you from Phoenix, Arizona, at the ABC meetings. ABC, I guess, owned it then, I guess, whatever it was, in the mid-90s. And he said, they've just made an announcement that they've decided to switch courses, and they are selling WJR, but keeping the, was it the Oakland Press? Yeah, the Oakland Press, I guess it was. It was either that or the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, or what? I'm a little confused about which newspaper. But they had made an announcement that they were selling the newspaper and keeping WJR. Now, all of a sudden, in the meeting, he says, they just announced they've changed their mind. They're selling WJR. So then he said, Mike Feasey said, I don't have to tell you this kind of news, and I feel bad doing it. I don't want this to change your decision at all, and you're thinking that you possibly could take this JR job. And I know we kind of shook hands, but he said, I feel as a good Christian, and Mike was a very deeply religious guy. The kids went to Christian school and so on and so forth. But anyway, he said, I feel as a good Christian, I have to tell you that they've announced they're selling WJR. I said, wow. Okay, he said, Mike, I said, I'll get back in touch with you, Mike. So I called my attorney, Henry Baskin, who had been involved in all this stuff, and I told him. And he said, I just got the same call from their attorney. And so I said, we better meet. So we met over at, was it 220 Merrill? And we had like a late lunch there and early dinner, whatever it was. And Henry wanted me to go to JR. And I said, Henry, I've been at WJR, but in Baltimore. I know they're saying I can do what I want. I know they're saying I've got freedom. I know they're saying I bring everybody over here. They're even saying I could play music if I wanted to. This is after they had dropped music. And they were willing to renew their license with the music, you know, ASCAP, BMI, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, but this is not, I don't feel right going there. It's not, I'd like it to be my kind of station. It's a wonderful radio station. It's a great station. But I mean, as a kid in Buffalo, because their signal sometimes goes across Lake Erie to Buffalo, and I said, I grew up listening to JR and CKLW. But I said, it's just not for me. Gail agreed with me totally, by the way, my wife. And so that was the end of it. I turned him down.
Purton told me about learning that two of the most famous and successful talents in radio today consider him their hero.
Speaking of, you know, on-air talent, it was really quite amazing that two different on-air talents in this country told me, both of them, one in person and one on the telephone, that I was their hero. And I laughed it off. And then I heard a little bit of the background as to why they said that. And those two talents were, the first one was Rush Limbaugh. The second one was Howard Stern.
Wow.
And so I look at the money these guys have made and how successful they have been. And to think I was their hero? Well, what it was in Limbaugh's case, he had been, as he later explained to me, he had been, and he's mentioned me on the air a couple of times, but he had worked in Pittsburgh with KQV Radio, and he was a disc jockey. And what I didn't know was that ABC, which owned KQV at the time, and WXYZ, where I was working at the time here, 1270, you know, AM, what I didn't know was that they were making copies of my put-on calls. They call them prank calls now or whatever, scammed, whatever you call them. That they were making copies of them, and they were mailing them to him, and he was listening to them and then doing them in Pittsburgh. And so that's how that happened about I was his hero. As far as the Howard Stern thing, we played a song called Liz Taylor Thighs. This is when I was this remember Liz Taylor? It was very heavy. And you can't say fat anymore. So anyway, she was very, very heavy. And so Larry Lawson, who's a doctor friend of mine, wrote this song called Liz Taylor Thighs to the tune of Betty Davis Eyes, which at the time was a huge song. And so I played that. Well, somewhere along the line, and to this day I don't really know how, the Washington Post picked up the story and printed it in their Sunday magazine. So a big deal. One of the, you know, in those days, the magazine with the Rotor Gravure was a colored, you know, a lot of colors in the magazine, and maybe still is. But anyway, well, Stern sees this story in the Washington Post about my song, Liz Taylor Thighs, playing it at, in Detroit and all this kind of stuff. It was on CKLW here when I was over there. Stern's telling people on the air, and I'm hearing it from people who happen to hear Stern in Washington, D.C., who are calling me, telling me this, Howard Stern, who had been in Detroit, remember, prior to this, that he is claiming that I stole his song. So I call up Howard one day, and I say, Howard, I understand, you know, that the folks that have heard your show there are claiming you stole, or I stole your song. Because he had a song called Liz Taylor Thighs. I said, Howard, I didn't steal your song. I didn't know you had a Liz Taylor song. And he said, Dick, he said, listen to Howard. He said, you know me, I just talk to talk. He said, I know you didn't steal a song. He said, as a matter of fact, I didn't even write it. He said, one of our listeners did. I said, well, a doctor friend of mine wrote mine. And so anyway, at this point, he said, listen, I was in Detroit for, a year, whatever it was. I'm on W4. And he said, I used to listen to you a lot, tape your show and a whole shot. And he said, you're my hero. That's what I wanted to do. And I said, well, Howard, I don't believe you. He said, no, really. I said, I don't believe you, but that's nice of you to say. Anyway, thank you very much. So I've always marveled at these two guys who don't play any music. They talk. And I guess you couldn't say there's two more successful people in the broadcasting business than those two guys. And I'm their hero? So I'll take it. What the heck?
Stay in touch with Detroit radio legend Dick Purton at facebook.com/Dick Purton. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.